Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for you as usual. And Ian, we start with the good, and it came from South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley yesterday. I'm guessing not every one of our listeners will like what she did, but the reason it's the good martini today is because obviously this issue over the Confederate flag has popped up from time to time in South Carolina. It popped up about 15 years ago when ultimately the decision was to keep it on the statehouse grounds but no longer fly it from the top of the Capitol Dome. And obviously in the wake of the Charleston shootings and the manifesto from the shooter and his constant references and images of the Confederate flag, there became another groundswell to take it down from the Capitol. And then ultimately, Nikki Haley agreed, and she was surrounded by members of both parties yesterday when she said it.
And the events of this past week call upon us to look at this in a different way. 15 years ago, after much contentious debate, South Carolina came together in a bipartisan way to move the flag from atop the Capitol Dome. Today, we are here in a moment of unity in our state, without ill will, to say it's time to move the flag from the Capitol grounds. For good and for bad, whether it is on the statehouse grounds or in a museum, the flag will always be a part of the soil of South Carolina. But this is a moment in which we can say that that flag, while an integral part of our past, does not represent the future of our great state.
Ian, obviously this became the latest gotcha question for the liberal media to every Republican they could find, both presidential candidates and otherwise, about their views on the Confederate flag. And so this question was ultimately unavoidable for Republicans. And in the end, I think while some on the right are not going to like this because they might think it will start a slippery slope somehow, the handling of this from Nikki Haley is to be applauded.
Haley did a good job. Her comments were both judicious in understanding the challenge that the issue of the Confederate flag presents and also charitable and offered in a spirit of reconciliation. So I think she's to be applauded for the way that she handled that. And as you said, there was a bipartisan group of legislators, political leaders with her that seemed to suggest that the decision was made in a spirit of unity and a real good faith effort to try to bring people together. And my hope, and I think the hope of a lot of people, is that that can be, her charitable decision can be met with charity on the other side as well. And that's sort of the question going forward is, will we be able to applaud what seems to be a moment of progress and true community, or will this just be an excuse to push for further concessions to advance an agenda that not all people might agree with? That's going to be the question going forward.
The interesting thing here, and there's a couple of different points, I guess, that could be made, is that you have different people who are obviously very supportive of this decision and are generally African-American activists who say this will finally unite the country. To say that this gesture, while significant, certainly, especially in light of what happened in South Carolina in the past several days, to say that this is going to solve all the problems we've been seeing in cities around the country in the last several years is going way too far, it would seem.
Oh, absolutely. It stems from a problem identifying causes and motivations. The reason that the Confederate battle flag has become such a pressing topic in this debate is because we did see Dylan Roth waving the flag, but also because there's an effort in many of these situations to institutionalize the blame and to offload it onto structural or systemic culprits. We see that often in episodes of violence where it's not about the shooter, it's about gun culture. You know, we see this when we talk about sexual assault. It's not about a single vicious predator, it's about rape culture. So while there is certainly good reason, I think, for people to come together in support of what South Carolina's governor has chosen to recommend to the state legislature, there are many who, while applauding that decision, also are misrepresenting the impact that it's going to have because they are invested not in identifying individuals with evil intentions, but in making culpable these large systems and apparatus, which is an excuse that simply doesn't pan out when you look at the facts of these things.
It would appear that there's momentum for this, but there are some lawmakers in South Carolina, and the legislature does have to weigh in on this apparently, who say, no, this is a part of our heritage, and we're not going to support the removal. So if, in fact, somehow this doesn't get approved by the legislature, how much will the media and the left try to paint the right with a very broad brush based on that vote?
Oh, sure, it'll be absolutely ugly. Yes, politically and in the media, it's going to be extremely ugly. But if this is South Carolina's legislature representing and trying to give voice to the sentiments of the majority, or I think the rule is two-thirds, three-fourths, it's pretty significant for removing the flag. If this is them representing the sentiments of South Carolinians, then maybe we should ask from those who have been so vehemently opposed to the flag to hear the other side, because I think in this debate, it's been very one-sided. There's been a single narrative that's been on offer from the vast majority of people, at least who've commented on this issue. Maybe if the South Carolina legislature chooses not to remove the flag from the grounds, it will force us to have a slightly more nuanced conversation.
Ian, let's move to the bad martini now. And it's not often that we get very public infighting amongst Republicans, but it's happening, it seems, more and more. And it's happening on the House side. Your own colleague, Joel Gerke, in National Review writes, John Boehner is not a man to be crossed. He talks about how Republicans who are not voting with the way the leadership wants to, especially when it comes to passing the rules for debate on a given piece of legislation, which is obviously considered a must-pass vote, three people stripped from their positions on the whip committee. You had Mark Meadows of North Carolina stripped from his chairmanship of a subcommittee on oversight. And there's a Iowa congressman who Boehner specifically campaigned for but did not get the vote of Rod Blum either in terms of the speaker vote back in January or on some recent votes, including TPA. So on the one hand, Boehner and his top lieutenants are firing back. Meanwhile, you've got the House Freedom Caucus, about 40 of the most conservative members of the House, looking for ways to plot revenge against the speaker for his retribution against them. So yes, it's a big majority, but it's a fractious one, it would appear.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we've seen this for several years, the years of Speaker Boehner's tenure, and I can sympathize with the difficult position he's in, having to try to wrangle a couple hundred Republicans into his preferred positions. There's the necessity that the speaker enforce discipline. The question here is whether this is simply enforcing discipline along sort of prudential, beneficial lines, or if there's something more at play. And the case that Joel wrote about is being touted as essentially the House leadership ultimately being willing to let a seat go blue in 2016 rather than have someone who's not going to bend to the leadership's whim. And that's a pretty extreme thing to countenance, despite the fact that Republicans have a significant majority in the House and are likely to keep it. What it seems to suggest is that the measures for discipline, for enforcing that discipline, are becoming more extreme because it's becoming very difficult for Speaker Boehner to keep everyone in line. The gentler measures of yesteryear are not sufficing, and what that suggests is that he's really having a great deal of trouble getting people to back him. We're certainly seeing that recently in the debate over TPA, TPP. Speaking to congressmen on the Hill, there's a good deal of conversation that would seem to suggest that he is going to have a very, very difficult time holding on to his gavel in 2016, and that it's very likely that Republicans will try to urge him behind the scenes not to do that. The extremity of these disciplinary measures now likely have a great deal to do with that.
Could be. And just ping-pongs back and forth. The leadership, of course, accusing the rank-and-file conservatives of being disloyal. The conservatives are accusing the leadership of not listening to them and actually taking more insight and suggestions from the Democrats, particularly on this debate, as they're trying to get some of those votes, than they are from their own membership. So it's going to be ugly, and we could see some very interesting primaries next year as well.
That's true.
As a result of that. And when you've got a fairly healthy majority, you can afford to have some of these fights, but it can also impact what's actually getting done for the American people, and specifically the people that voted to put this huge majority in place. But on to the crazy martini now, and this actually happened over the weekend. It's a little bit tough to describe in an audio podcast, Ian, but it was the Associated Press publishing a photo, a series of photos actually, of Texas Senator and 2016 presidential candidate Ted Cruz at a Second Amendment event, and there is a big picture of Ted Cruz speaking, and on the wall to his left is a pistol that looks to be aimed right at the senator's forehead, and depending on which way he's looking, sometimes it looks like the gun's about to shoot him in the side of the head. And AP says, well, we just took a series of photos at this event. The images, and this is a quote, were not intended to portray Senator Cruz in a negative light. And of course, you have conservative bloggers and Fox News saying the only pictures we've ever seen with things near President Obama's head are lighting that makes it look like he has a halo. And there's not a prominent Democrat in the world that AP would run a photo of like that. So on the one hand, it is a gun event. On the other hand, it appears to perhaps be a double standard, Ian. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Listeners will recall the Michelle Bachmann Newsweek cover, I believe it was, from the 2012 primaries, where she looks positively ghastly. They specifically chose that photograph. You have some of the best photographers and media design folk involved in these publications. AP certainly is among them. They've got plenty of photos to choose from. Obviously, people noticed this. It wasn't some sort of accident. And so, absolutely, there was probably a little snickering behind the scenes that went on when they selected this photograph. And of course, they wouldn't do it for Elizabeth Warren or Chuck Schumer or any of the rest. The more interesting question, of course, and it's a rather macabre one, and we'll pray to God nothing like this happens, but we heard endlessly when Representative Gabby Giffords was shot in Arizona a few years back that it was Sarah Palin's bullseyes in regards to congressional districts to target that had led Jared Loughner to pull the trigger. So if, again, God forbid, something were to happen to Ted Cruz, will we see the left-wing media jumping to blame this Associated Press photograph for that incident of violence? I seriously doubt it.
On that sobering note, there does seem to be an interesting standard on what is allowed and what is not, depending on the candidate or the political figure and their ideology, perhaps more importantly. Ian, it's been great having you fill in for Jim. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and please tune in on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.